As Marion went with Neville to the door, Robert heard her say, "Well done." Why do they sound so friendly, so at ease together, Robert wondered. "Is the sherry too dry for you, Mr. Blair?" Mrs. Sharp asked. No. Oh, no, thank you. It's excellent." Was it possible he had been looking sour? Perish the thought. He took a cautious glance at the old lady and thought she was looking faintly amused. Soon after, he made his own excuses. As he left, he said, "I'll let you know tomorrow night how I get on, and I'll ring up Inspector Hallam and see if the police can give a look round the franchise once or twice a day, just to discourage idlers." "You're very kind," Marion said. "I can't imagine what we would do without you to lean on." Well, if he couldn't be young and a poet, he could be a crutch. A dull thing, but useful. Useful. By 10:30 on Monday morning, Robert was sitting in front of a steaming cup of coffee in the Carina Cafe, holding the Ac Emma newspaper with the girl's photograph open to the gaze of the waitresses as they passed by. At 12:30, he staggered into the lounge of the Midland and called for strong waters. As far as he knew, he had covered all the likely eating places in Loughborough, and not one of the waitresses remembered seeing the girl. As Albert, the lounge waiter, set his drink in front of him, Robert asked, more out of habit than volition, "I suppose you've never seen this girl, Albert?" Albert looked at the newspaper and shook his head. "No, sir, not that I recollect. Looks a little young, if I may say so, for the lounge of the Midland." "She mightn't look so young with her hat on," Robert said, considering it. "A hat? No. Wait a minute, a hat." Albert picked up the paper. "Of course. That's the girl in the green hat, of course. It's some time ago now, isn't it? About 6 weeks or so, must be. She always came early, about 3, when we start serving teas." So that's what she did. She came out of the cinema about 3 and had tea, not coffee. But why the Midland? The first time she came, I thought she was waiting for relations. That's the kind of kid she looked, you know. Nice plain clothes, a green hat and a pale grey coat and no airs. And then one day she picked up the man at the next table. You could have knocked me over with a feather.
You mean he picked her up?
Don't you believe it. He hadn't even thought of her. I tell you, sir, she didn't look that sort. You'd expect an aunt or a mother to appear at any moment and say, "So sorry to have kept you waiting, darling." But, oh, no, it was the kid's doing. And as neat a piece of business, let me tell you, as if she'd spent a lifetime at it.
What was the man like? Did you know him?
No. He wasn't one of our regulars. Dark, youngish, business gent, I'd say. Robert had known Albert for nearly 20 years. "It's like this, Albert," he said. "These people are my clients." He tapped the photograph of the franchise, and Albert gave a low whistle. "A tough spot for you, Mr. Blair."
"Yes, but mostly for them. The police can't afford to give constant protection, so you can imagine the lives these women are leading. My young cousin, who looked in before dinner last night, says that from lunchtime on, crowds of cars arrived from Loughborough to stare or take photographs, and the telephone went continually until they asked the exchange not to put through any more calls. You see the spot we're in. Unless we can find out where the girl was during the weeks she says she was at the franchise."
"Well, if it is the girl in the green hat, I'd say she was what is known as out on the tile, sir. Very cool customer she was for a girl of that age. Butter wouldn't melt in her mouth."
"Butter wouldn't melt in her mouth," was what the tobacconist in London had said of the child, Betty. And on the tiles had also been Stanley at the garage's verdict on the face that was so like the bint he'd had in Egypt. Robert had lunch, and then made a telephone call. Scotland Yard would most certainly have a description of the clothes the girl was wearing when she went missing, and in less than 7 minutes he had it. A green felt hat, a green wool frock, a pale grey cloth coat, fawn grey rayon stockings, and black court shoes with medium heels. Jubilation filled him. The hypothetical ex had ceased to be hypothetical. He could go back to the franchise in triumph. But how did one follow up a young, dark business gent who had tea in the lounge of the Midland about 6 weeks previously? He was afraid that this was where he handed over to a professional bloodhound. It would be a long process of small inquiries, a job for an expert. All he could do was get a list of residents at the Midland for the period in question. The manager of the Midland was sympathetic about the ladies at the franchise and comfortingly cynical about smooth-faced young girls who look as if butter wouldn't melt in their mouths. Robert pocketed the horribly long list of residents' names the manager gave him as one pockets a passport. Its actual value was probably nil, but it gave him a nice feeling to have it. On the way home, as he came within sight of the franchise, he found the stretch of road deserted. Miraculously, there were no sightseers. As he came nearer, he saw why. At the gate, solid and immobile, was the dark blue and silver figure of a policeman. Robert slowed down to exchange greetings, but the greetings died on his lips. Along the full length of the wall, in letters nearly 6 feet high, was splashed the word, "Fascists." Robert stopped the car and got out slowly. "Is it whitewash?" he asked.
"No, Mr. Blair, paint. Some people never grow out of it, do they?"
"Out of what?"
"Writing things on walls."
"Well, I'll send someone either tonight or first thing in the morning to do something about this obscenity. Are you staying here?"
"The sergeant said I was to stay till dark. They'll be all right once the light's gone. People don't like the country once it gets dark."
Robert, who remembered how silent the lonely house could be, felt doubtful.
"Don't worry, sir," the force said, watching his face. "This is England, after all."
"So is their Ak Emma newspaper, England," Robert reminded him. But he got back into his car. The force was no doubt right. Once the dark came, everyone would go home. As he turned his car into the garage in Sin Lane, Stanley Peters was shrugging off his overalls outside the office door. "I've been trying to get someone to wipe a slogan off the walls of the franchise," Robert told him, "but everyone is extraordinarily busy all of a sudden."
"What kind of slogan?" Stanley asked him,
and Bill Bruff, hearing the exchange, lounged out of the narrow office door to listen as Robert explained.
"When I was in the signals in the war," Stanley said, beginning in a leisurely fashion to pull his overalls back on, "I was given a free tour of Italy, and I got a phobia while I was there. I took a great dislike to slogans on walls."
"What'll we get it off with?" Bill asked.
"What's the good of owning the best-equipped garage in Milford?" Stanley said, "if we haven't got something to take off a spot of paint."
At home, Robert picked up the telephone to talk.
"Oh, you! How nice," Marion said,
when at last he had persuaded the post office that his intentions were honourable. And the warmth in her voice, catching him unawares, left him breathless for a moment.
"I suppose you've seen our wall decoration?"
He said yes, but by the time the sun rose, it would have gone. "The two men who own the garage I use have decided to obliterate it tonight," he said. "And I have more good news for you. I have established the fact that X exists. Betty Kane picked him up at the Midland."
"Picked him up," Marion said. "But she's just a child."
"Oh, well, she told that story, of course. After that, anything is possible." Robert went to bed early that night, but lay awake in a restless mood. And about midnight, he heard a car drive up and stop, and presently Bill's cautious whisper,
"Mr. Blair! Mr. Blair!"
Robert was at the window at once.
"What is it?" "There's trouble at the franchise. I've got to go for the police because the telephone wire's cut, but I thought you'd want to be called."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Hooligans. I'll come for you on my way back."
"Is Stanley with them?"
"Yes. He's having his head bound up. Back in a minute."
Before Robert had got his clothes on, he heard a shush go past his window and realized the police were already on their way. As he opened the front door, Bill drove up. "Tell me," Robert said, as they moved away.
"Well," Bill said, "we finished that little job, removing the slogan, and were just thinking of pushing off, when there was a crash of glass. Then we heard more crashing and realized that they were making a night of it. We caught up with them near the front of the house. I think there were seven of them, far more than we'd expected. Anyhow, suddenly there was quiet. We'd been making a lot of noise, and I realized we were letting them get away. Stan said, from somewhere on the ground, 'Grab one, Bill, before they get over the wall.' Well, The last of them was just being helped over, and I grabbed his legs and hung on. But he kicked like a mule and was over before I could grab him again. So I went back to stand. Someone had hit him a wallop over the head with what he said was a bottle, and he was looking very cheap. And then Miss Sharp came out and said, was someone hurt? So we got Stan in. I went to the phone, but Miss Sharp said, oh, that's no use, it's dead. We tried to call the police when they first arrived. So I said I'd go and fetch them. And I said I'd better fetch you too, but Miss Sharp said, no, you'd had a very hard day, but I thought you ought to be in on it.
Quite right, Bill, I ought. In the drawing room at the franchise, Stanley was having a cut above his eyebrow attended to by Marion, and a sergeant of police was taking notes.
Oh, Bill, I told you not to, Marion said, as she saw Robert.
There was a very large array of missiles, consisting mostly of bricks and bottles, laid out on the floor. Mrs. Sharp came in with coffee. Robert refused it, having seen enough coffee lately to lose interest, but the colour began to come back into Stan's face.
Do you plan to stay on here, ma'am? The sergeant asked.
Certainly, Mrs. Sharp said. What do a few broken windows matter?
It may not stop at broken windows.
What you want is a lodger, said Stanley. What do you say I come and sleep here nights?
Haven't you got a wife? Marion asked. Not of my own, Stanley said demurely.
Your wife, if you had one, might support your sleeping here, Mrs. Sharp pointed out, but I doubt if your business would, Mr. Peters.
My business?
I imagine if your customers found you had become night watchman at the franchise, they would take their custom elsewhere.
Not them, Stanley said comfortably. There's nowhere else to take it. Anyhow, I don't let my customers tell me what I do in my spare time.
Well, Marion said, I'll go and make up a bed. It was arranged that Bill should slip a note into Stanley's lodgings.
She won't worry about me, Stanley said, referring to his landlady. I've been out nights before now.
He caught Marion's eye.
Ferrying cars for customers. You can do it in half the time at night.
Bill wasn't listening. He said,
it's funny how unsafe you feel in a house without windows.
Which was not an observation which provided Robert with any comfort.